COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
I wish I could say what his intent would have been, had he been able to get his weapon trained on me. Would he have lived?
These are the written words of Illinois inmate B13199, Elton Williams.
But in such situations, the fight or flee instinct kicks into overdrive, and I was forced to fight, so I fought.
They're taken from letters that he wrote to us in 2019.
He responded predictably. He searched for his weapon, at which point I grabbed mine and fired.
I'm documentary producer Ned Parker, and Elton Williams is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Zoe Hines and I have corresponded with in our work investigating violent crime and the lives of the people who enact it.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 10, Cop Killer.
Most people are probably instinctively comfortable with the concept of having different legal categorizations for crimes which have led to a death. First-degree murder, second-degree murder, manslaughter. But in various US states, the legal system applies an additional distinction to murder cases. Those which fall into the category of capital murder and those which do not. It varies state to state, but if the killer has multiple victims, is a hired killer, or kills in the course of a prison escape, these are all factors which can result in a capital murder charge. But there are two distinctions, which are seemingly applied more frequently than any other, and both apply to our letter writer for this episode. The first is that any murder committed in the course of carrying out another crime, like a kidnapping, burglary, or robbery, is considered solid grounds for a capital murder charge. And the second is that in US states with the death penalty, the killing of a police officer who is acting in the lawful discharge of their duties will inevitably see prosecutors push for the toughest sentence possible in an attempt to send the cop killer to death row.
This episode comes with a specific content warning because it details the brutal murder of a serving police officer.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. September 1994, Crest Hill, Illinois. Shortly after midnight, Arbor Club resident Bill Cheney parked his car and crossed the street to his apartment. As he approached the entrance, Elton Williams charged at him from the darkness, holding an altered .22 caliber rifle. Cheney threw his wallet towards the assailant and ran into his apartment, where he dialed 911. At 12:23 a.m., Cheney reported the robbery and gave the details of a white car that he believed was his attacker's. Sergeant Tim Simonson was in the area and was dispatched to investigate. As he neared the apartments, he saw a white car that fitted the description and reported the license plates. Simonson reported that he was going to apprehend the car at an upcoming junction. Hearing this call-in, a nearby officer, Ralph Smith, proceeded to the location to assist, where he was joined by another officer. On arriving at the scene, Officer Smith reported that Simonson had already stopped the suspect's white car and was in the process of apprehending the driver. Simonson reported the driver's name as Gregory Shaw. Before continuing his routine inspection of shining his flashlight inside the car, removing the keys, and instructing Shaw to move to the rear of the car. It was then that Shaw sat on the trunk, reluctant to move, before being ordered to get into the squad car. Simonson was compelled to investigate further. He unlocked the trunk and opened it, shining his flashlight directly into the eyes of Elton Williams. Gunshots were fired as Williams shot Sergeant Simonson twice in the face. Williams then tried to shoot Officer Smith, but the gun jammed. Smith was triggered to act, shooting Williams inside the trunk once in the forearm and once in the buttocks before successfully restraining him. From the time of the robbery to the murder of Sergeant Simonson, only 15 minutes had passed.
We're focusing on the case and letters of Elton Williams. But it's also important not to forget the role of his accomplice, Gregory Shaw. Shaw was clearly aware that Elton Williams had a rifle. He was also aware that Williams had hidden in the trunk in order to evade arrest, to the point that Gregory Shaw sat on the trunk of the car, presumably in an effort to try and protect Williams. And that's exactly what aroused Sergeant Simonson's suspicions and led to his death.
But how could Shaw have known that Williams was going to fire his rifle? And even if he did, to what degree does that make Gregory Shaw responsible for the murder of the police sergeant? We'll come back to Shaw's sentencing when we reach the verdict, but for now, let's focus on the letters of Elton Williams.
We asked Williams to write about his formative years to see if we could perhaps find any factors that may have contributed to the path that led him to prison. These are the words of an actor, but they are Elton Williams' words, as written to us in his letters.
I wasn't rich, nor was I poverty-stricken. My mom was a single parent, for the most part, but she did very well, as far as I'm concerned. I was raised by six amazing women, grandmother, mom, and four sisters, who smothered me with love. They all took time out to engage me and make me feel wanted, appreciated, helping them with homework, including me in activities, being sisters and friends, though I was a bit of a pest. As for aspirations, I really only had one. That was to be a soldier. My brother and I would always wear school paper by drawing tanks, planes, and men fighting make-believe wars and bonding over this. We had very active imaginations, going on contrived adventures together, fighting the bad guys, and always winning. In my world, and everyone's world, all over the world, there exists myriad bad influences from the cradle to the grave. Children engage in illegal and immoral activities. Some people call it human nature. I smoked marijuana before the age of 12, as I hung around those who did. There's always at least one person in the group who is more mature or more worldly than the rest. And these tend to have access to items, images, and substances that those who lived in households where corporal punishment was doled out more readily did not.
The first thing that strikes me about Elton Williams is that this is a rare kind of response to the question about formative years. It's not often that we read inmates' accounts where they write about being raised by amazing women, smothering them with love. Williams also details a close relationship with his brother. He's not trying to blame other people for his life choices or his actions. And he's not citing that he came from a family where he didn't have options or that criminality was common around him. All in all, this seems like a happy childhood.
His is also a very sophisticated correspondence. A phrase that sticks out to me is,
in my world and everyone's world, all over the world, there exists myriad bad influences from the cradle to the grave.
The vocabulary and the construction of that sentence is very considered. The perspective is astonishing. He's using educated phrasing in combination with writing about a positive upbringing, and that, for me, sets his letter apart from many that we read. But it also begs the question, what went wrong?
From our position as documentary producers, this is a strong start in terms of the story that you hope you're going to hear, because Williams appears to be someone who you feel is going to be taking responsibility for themselves. But I think it is important to note that at this stage in his letters, Williams hasn't actually talked to us about the night of the murder itself. And he doesn't until the fifth exchange we have with him. He seems instead to want to focus on the story of his personal growth.
But let's turn the pages and go directly to the events leading up to the murder, as they give a good insight as to how his condition has changed in later years. In this extract, Williams writes about his own family, and in particular, his middle son.
On the day of the killing, I was an emotional wreck. I was overwhelmed by a personal issue that I had no power to rectify, and I wanted so badly for that not to be an issue. My middle son, Jeremiah, had been born blind, and it wore heavily on me. His condition was no excuse for me to do what I did that night, but I wanted to provide some context in my response to your questions. He was born in February 1994, and throughout the months, I could feel myself falling, but I thought I could handle whatever. On September 28, 1994, I crashed. Being high and somewhat drunk, being emotionally overwhelmed, I got in my head to solve a problem that didn't exist. I needed money, more than I was bringing in. Given the condition of my son, you'd think I'd have planned a bank heist. But my mind was so messed up and caught up in the throes of immaturity that I opted to pursue crumbs, imagining that I was undertaking action in some righteous cause.
In this extract, Elton Williams traces a direct line between his son's disability and a perceived, although admittedly exaggerated, need for money that drove him to commit crime. He uses the phrase a righteous cause, implying that the money would somehow go towards supporting him and perhaps even medical assistance for his son.
Life has thrown Williams a curveball, and he is now a different person to the optimistic boy that we had in the first extract who was showered with love. And he's pulling at relatable, familiar heartstrings at this point. But then his letters begin to skim over events such as a chance meeting with his accomplice, Gregory Shaw, and taking part in the robbery.
I ended up running into Gregory Shaw, and this chance meeting was another one of those unexpected and highly unlikely occurrences that played out that night. I never hung out with Greg, ever. It was truly one of those freaky-ass nights where all signals pointed to disaster for me, and I just couldn't see them. Still, I acted, and I take responsibility for that. I robbed a guy with only the intention of taking his money, and he, being still alive, called the police as he should have. The great criminal mind I was, a bit of a joke there, I declared that I would hide myself in the trunk to avoid detection. I asked Greg to drive the car. We were pulled over without permission from the driver, who was not identified as a suspect by the victim, Sergeant Simonson, and took it upon himself to violate Gregory Shaw's rights against illegal searches, and removing the keys from the ignition, he proceeded to search the trunk of the car. Upon opening the trunk, his surprise of finding me there was obvious, and, as a simple human, he responded predictably because of his training, attempting to control the situation. Seeing no threat whatsoever, he searched for his weapon, at which point I grabbed mine and fired. The robbery victim was still alive, so it should have been obvious that I had no desire to physically harm anyone.
In the middle of this extract, there's a real shift that doesn't sit well with me, and it's the part where William says that Sergeant Simonson took it upon himself to violate Gregory Shaw's rights against illegal searches, removing the key from the ignition and proceeding to search the trunk of the car.
That line comes out of nowhere for me. Suddenly, it's as if to say that this was all Sergeant Simonson's fault. If he hadn't overstepped the line, he might still be alive.
Up to this point, Williams has written in a way that demonstrates compassion and understanding. But here he seems to switch. He just brushes over the murder of Sergeant Simonson, even making a joke about his great criminal mind.
Also saying that the police should somehow have known that they posed no threat because the victim of the robbery was still alive. No matter how well-trained, how experienced he is as a police officer, unexpectedly, seeing someone with a rifle pointed at you when you open the trunk of a car, the tendency is going to be to react.
In previous references to his son and his upbringing, Williams has demonstrated the ability to put himself in the position of others. So it's notable that he doesn't hear. He's become overwhelmed by his own narrative at this point.
And as he continues to write to us, he does fixate on this issue of Sergeant Simonson's actions.
The reality is that I should not have been able to fire first. He had the jump on me. But for the internal locking mechanism contained within his holster, which was there to prevent any suspect from relieving the officer of his weapon, I would have been deceased. And though he didn't remove it fast enough, he did remove it. Nobody else could have. I wish I could say what his intent would have been, had he been able to get his weapon trained on me. Would he have lived? Would he have arrested me? having experience of what I've experienced after the fact, I often wish that I'd have waited to see. But in such situations, the fight or flee instinct kicks into overdrive, and I was forced to fight. So I fought.
We've come full circle in his analysis of the night in question now, from Williams seemingly first taking complete responsibility for his actions, to suddenly events not being in his control at all, to now confidently stating that he was in no doubt that Sergeant Simerson was going to shoot him dead. Now, we do have to bear in mind that there are an awful lot of instances of people dying by the hands of the police in America, specifically African Americans. And this is probably a moment when we should point out that Elton Williams is an African American man.
But arguably, a family who have lost a loved one at the hands of potentially racist police brutality would actually take offence at the fact that Elton Williams is trying to shift the blame here and utilise this as a defence in this instance.
There is no way for Elton Williams to be able to say with confidence, certainly not in the way that he does, that Simerson would have died, and to say, in some ways, I wish I'd waited to see what would happen. These are not the words of someone who actually has remorse for what they've done, as far as I can see. It feels to me like he has fallen into this pattern of saying that this was beyond his control and not thinking about the situation as being one that has occurred through the actions that he himself has taken.
We've heard Elton Williams' thoughts on the actual events of that night, but when we wrote to Williams, we also wanted to ask about his experiences on entering the prison system as a known cop killer. And this is something that Elton Williams offered up out of sequence. He actually wrote to us about this prior to writing about the murder itself. So for this section, we're going to cycle back to an earlier letter. And what's really noticeable here is that we return to that same self-reflective, self-deprecating, empathetic voice that we heard in the very first extracts.
My first few days in prison were weird. Most acted as though I was some sort of celebrity, and I didn't know how to feel about that. I just kept quiet, watching people talk, and acted as though I dispensed some measure of justice and struck a blow for some cause I didn't embrace. I definitely regret my actions. Not just the shooting, but everything that led up to it. My taking the actions I took, my weakness, my emotional immaturity are all the reason Sergeant Simerson and I met that night. I can't say whether or not he would have still been alive had we not met. No one can know that. But he might have survived that night. We all might have. He might have gone on one more night with his children, and I deeply regret depriving them of that. I'm not the same person that I was that night. Some of us actually mature out of immaturity. We outgrow our criminal predilections. Life becomes odious to us. Being forced to sit still forces most of us to take an accounting of ourselves. Introspection leads to knowledge of oneself, and if a person is honest about what's found, he or she gives themselves the opportunity to take a turn in their lives.
Williams writes about his discomfort with a sense of celebrity which was attached to him as a known cop killer when he arrived in prison, and he says that this cause against the police is a cause that he doesn't actually embrace. In fact, he regrets his actions. And he points to his weakness as emotional immaturity. For me, that's a very different Elton Williams to the one that we've just been hearing from when he was writing about the murder.
It's very much a return to form. At this point, he's writing about his vulnerability and his fallibility and his reluctance to serve as a figurehead for a cause that he's saying he wasn't actually fighting for is laudable. No matter how much people try to say he was fighting some kind of fight, he's saying, actually, you know, I wasn't. I was just immature. I was weak. But by the time Williams writes to us about the night of the crime itself, this self-deprecating awareness is gone, and he's laying the blame firmly at someone else's feet.
And yet, even now as we're looking at this section from one of Williams' earlier letters, I feel like the alarm bells probably should have been going off for me, because he does start to write in this more fatalistic, kind of narcissistic way about how the killing of Sergeant Simerson has impacted on him or changed him.
I honestly believe things that couldn't be avoided cannot be changed, even if one could go back in time. My younger self was stubborn and hard-headed. My younger self made every sincere effort to get off the path that led me to this. There's nothing I could tell myself that the women in my life hadn't told him many times over, especially my sister-in-law's mother, Debbie. But it serves that any road would have gotten me here because I had to be here. It's only since I've been here that my heart and my mind have gotten quiet enough to hear the message that my ladies were trying to give me. And yes, people will say that I came to prison and found God. Nothing could be further from the truth. God has always been here with me.
We've come across these sort of fatalistic expressions in a couple of the writers that we've looked at in the series. Sandoval, Jojobo, Duke, for example. And the phrase which often comes up is, everything happens for a reason. There is a purpose to everything. And although he doesn't say that specifically, that is very much the sentiment that he's expressing here, isn't it?
Yeah. I was destined to take this path. I had no control over what happened to Sergeant Simonson. This was a predefined instance that was always going to happen. And I think it plays into something else we see in this passage. He uses language to distance himself from someone who even tried to fight against this, to split himself in two. My younger self was stubborn and hard-headed. My younger self made every sincere effort to get off this path. It's a step further back from acceptance of responsibility, and I imagine that could be very hard for a victim's family to hear.
And one of the reasons that this story fascinated me was that I was interested in how police officers are disproportionately killed compared to people in other walks of life in the US. Now, that's not necessarily a huge surprise. They are in a more dangerous profession, but Sergeant Simonson had a very good track record and by all extents was an honourable and respectable serving police officer, so much so that his dad had written a book about him. And as it happens, that book somehow ends up in the hands of Elton Williams in his prison cell, and he writes about reading it in his letter.
A friend of mine brought me a copy of Sergeant Simonson's dad's book. I read it several times. I still have it. And I have to admit, I'm impressed with the story of his life. It reads as though he is destined for a career in law enforcement, and circumstances were such that his calling would not be derailed. I think he might have been someone I might have respected had we met under different circumstances. It was on death row that I finally awoke from my stupor. When you're alone, there's no one to deal with but yourself, and everybody's got unfinished business with themselves. I spent a lot of time trying to figure me out, and though it took me a lot of time, I got there. Eventually, I made the decision based on my recognition of my need for change, that if I ended up being executed, I'd die a better man than I'd lived up to this point.
I find this a conflicting part of William's letter. He's expressing remorse and even admiration for his victim. But he's also expressing that in a particular way, that it's somehow still all about him. But I do believe him when he writes that he wants to die a better man than he previously lived, which again feels like a normal sentiment, but is just placing the onus disproportionately on him as opposed to the loss of the life of his victim. And the overall feeling that I get from Elton Williams' letters is this sense of disappointment, because unlike many of the inmates who write to us, William seems so close to being able to comprehend his actions and to be able to express mature feelings of remorse and acceptance of what he's done. And yet he descends back into victim blaming, diminishing responsibility as far as he's concerned, this simplistic, fatalistic outlook. And it's all happened for a reason in order to bring me closer to God. And that is, to me, the biggest tragedy in reading these letters. He seems like someone who could turn that corner, and he could be someone who really has something worth saying.
At the beginning of this podcast, we referred to William's accomplice, Gregory Shaw, and it's now time to bring him back into the equation. We did write to Gregory Shaw in addition to Elton Williams, but we haven't included his letters in this podcast because, in the end, Gregory Shaw, on the advice of his lawyers, said that he didn't wish to participate. He was continuing to contest the charges against him, but Shaw's role on the night of the murder is something we should definitely consider as we look at the verdict in this case.
Letters from a Killer. The Verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. December 14th, 1995. A jury of six men and six women took just half an hour to return a verdict of guilty to the charges of armed robbery and capital murder in the first degree. December 29th, 1995. Circuit Court Judge Rodney Livewell sentenced Elton Williams to death. Gregory Shaw was found guilty of felony murder, but avoided the death penalty.
Let's define some of the terms here, because different categories of murder have different sentencing implications.
One particular phrase which we hear a lot is capital murder. And all that really means is a murder which could end up with a death sentence. Capital murder is commonly given when a murder is committed during the act of another crime, such as a robbery. So the 15 minutes between the robbery and the murder of Sergeant Simerson constitutes the continuation of the same crime in this instance. And it's for that reason that Elton Williams was charged with capital murder, and for that reason that he received the death penalty.
So what about Gregory Shaw?
Shaw was charged with felony murder. In the UK, we might understand that as joint enterprise, the idea that you are guilty of a crime, even if you haven't committed it yourself, but because you have been a part of the process of that crime. Gregory Shaw hadn't been identified as being the driver of the car in the armed robbery, which had occurred 15 minutes earlier, which meant he escaped capital murder, but it still made it a capital offence. He was deemed by the court to have been aware of the potential threat to life, which was faced by Sergeant Simerson at that moment, and he did nothing to try and stop it. Clearly, he knew that Elton Williams was hidden in the trunk of the car with a rifle as Sergeant Simerson approached it. But Gregory Shaw was still charged with felony murder, and he was not given the death penalty. Now, one might feel that charging Gregory Shaw with murder, despite not having pulled the trigger, is almost an over-sentencing.
Looking at the original sentencing of these two accomplices does seem particularly interesting when you then consider what happened in 2003. Several years after Elton Williams was sent to death row, Illinois Governor George Ryan issued a blanket clemency order, which meant that every Illinois inmate with the death penalty was resentenced to life. So in the case of Gregory Shaw and Elton Williams, that meant that these two individuals ended up with very similar sentences, despite their very different roles in this crime.
In this episode of Letters from a Killer, we've explored the letters of Elton Williams.
Given the condition of my son, you'd think I'd have planned a bank heist. But my mind was so messed up and caught up in the throes of immaturity that I opted to pursue crumbs.
His letters raise issues around responsibility and denial of his lethal actions.
There's a paradox in the way Elton Williams writes. Self-deprecating, then narcissistic. Answerable, then a blameless victim of fate.
I'm not the same person that I was that night. Some of us actually mature out of immaturity. I honestly believe things that couldn't be avoided cannot be changed, even if one could go back in time.
The case is very complex, involving multiple accomplices and some very specific judicial outcomes, which resulted in lengthy sentencing. But in his letters, it seems that Williams is somebody who gets so disappointingly close to accepting responsibility for his actions, yet falls so far short in actually believing it.
Next time on Letters from a Killer. Whatever makes you happy.
After 18 years of solitary confinement with death breathing down my neck, some things don't matter as much as they used to. I'm not the one who killed Christina. But hey, whatever makes you happy.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big.